During this time of Lent, we take time now to reflect on the events crowning the last days of Christ's life before his crucifixion, and how they have been depicted in Christian art throughout the ages. We begin by looking at the Last Supper, when Christ, surrounded by the 12 apostles, blesses the bread and wine, and commands his disciples to go forth and do the same in his memory for the salvation of all men. Though famous in its own right, Leonardo's masterpiece depiction of the Last Supper gained even more global renown, if that's possible, following the publication of Dan Brown's Da Vinci Code. But Leonardo certainly wasn't the first to paint the theme. Christian art historian Elizabeth Lev explains.
The Last Supper, like many of these great moments in the Passion cycle, is a very, very old image. The use of the Last Supper in the way that has come to our attention through the Da Vinci Code is something that began in the 14th century. As far as we know, it's in the 1300s in the Church of 1350 circa, in the Church of Santa Croce, a Franciscan church in Florence, that we have the first Last Supper to be painted in a refectory. And it was painted by one of Giotto's best students, whose name was Taddeo Gaddi, and it is stretched out across the wall the same way that eventually Leonardo's painting would be. And Leonardo's painting has to be thought of as a long progression. I mean, from 1350 to 1495 is quite a bit of time and quite a bit of evolution for the image of the Last Supper. But the important thing about this image is that it becomes a stock in trade for a refectory. It becomes the image that goes in the place where monks, particularly religious, will sit and eat their three communal meals a day. They eat these meals in silence, with this image in the background to remind them of, you know, the most famous meal in history. One of the things that I found particularly inappropriate about the Last Supper and the way it was portrayed in the Da Vinci Code, and something that I think is very appropriate to think about in a Lenten reflection, because after all, the monks are sort of living a lifetime of Lent, is that the reason why this image, which is usually surmounted by a crucifixion, by the way, is put into these refectories has to do with the monastic life. I mean, these men who the option of martyrdom isn't really that open after the 4th century AD. I mean, most of the martyrs, martyrdom is not that easy to come by once Diocletian's edicts are over. But there are still many, many people who want to give their lives to God in the most complete and total way they can. And it involves, in this case, the monasticism involves dying to oneself. So those men who are sitting at that table, or the women, many of them show up in the refectories of religious sisters. These men and women have opted out of being able to choose what you do in the morning, things that you and I take for granted. Choose what you do, choose what you have for breakfast, pick out your own clothes, get married, have children, leave a legacy of a family. They die to all that, and they live their lives completely for Christ. So when they sit in front of that painting and they see Jesus and the apostles stretched out in front of them three times a day, it's a reminder of their commitment to follow Christ's passion from, you know, not in a blaze of glory like St. Lawrence or St. Stephen or one of our dramatic martyrs, but in a long everyday renewal of a commitment to die to themselves, to live for Christ. So this is one of the great beauties of these paintings.
Would the Last Supper have been among the themes brought out also on the catacomb walls here in Rome?
The Last Supper, actually, it does not show up in the very early painting in the catacombs. Mm. It shows up in a later stage of painting. For reasons that we aren't really sure, the Christological cycle starts out really trying to avoid images of Christ's passion. The earliest images in the catacombs that deal with Christ are the three wise men, the nativity, the miracles. But the story of the Last Supper, it starts, Christ before Pilate is often where the story just sort of peters out. And that's already in the 4th century. So it's maybe a difficulty of having to put all the figures together and being able to narrate the story with, you know, which one is Judas and which one is Peter and which one is John. But for some reason, this image doesn't actually show up until you start to have actual panel painting in Christianity.
How popular was it, for example, to depict the Last Supper scene in churches? I'm thinking here in Rome in particular.
Well, the Last Supper scene itself shows up in the huge painting cycles. And when the walls of the church are painted, which starts to come in and around, Leo the Great has the walls painted in St. Peter's in the 5th century. When St. Peter's and St. Paul's and St. John Lateran have the big, huge cycles going along the side, then they start to show the Last Supper. It's just kind of a regular part of the cycle of the stories of Christ, which mirror the stories of the Old Testament. And there's a whole kind of program for painting. But it's in this Renaissance era that we really see the separation of this one story and the glorification of this one story and an intense meditation on the part of the greatest artists that live of this in this era to really bring out the mortal element, the human element in the story, to bring out the divine and mystical element in the story. And each artist has a different way of approaching it.
Going back just quickly to the Leonardo painting.
I would like to note just a quick note about the placement of Judas, which maybe is obvious to most of your listeners, but it's always been, and it's again a very good Lenten moment and very, very well thought out by Leonardo da Vinci. The knot of Judas and Peter and John, which are the three different reactions to Christ's announcement. And John, who knows it's not him, is unthinkable, absolutely is sort of calm, drawn back, but not possible. Peter, the bluster, and I'd never betray you, and yet the man who will deny Christ. And Judas, the one that we all think, oh, he's the bad guy, always pushed into our space. You always know it's Judas because he's always closest to us, because we are far more like Judas than even Peter, and certainly far more like Judas than ever John. And that's a very important part that all of these paintings have in common.
It was to the Garden of Gethsemane that Jesus, knowing well what was soon to befall him, withdrew with some of his apostles to pray. While there, the apostles fell asleep, and Jesus was left alone among the olive trees to agonize over his tragic but life-giving destiny. Though it's a pivotal and heart-wrenching event in Christ's passion, the agony in the garden has not been widely depicted in Christian art. But one scene of the agony is found here in the Vatican, and other depictions of the event can even be found in more modern forms of art.
There's one very small image of the agony in the garden represented by Cosimo Rosselli, one of the painters of the Sistine Chapel in the 1480s. But it's a very small window. It's actually part of the last panel on the right-hand side panels of the stories of Christ. And it's the Last Supper with three windows looking outside of the room of the Last Supper, and the first window on the left shows this agony in the garden. But
so you're actually in the room of the Last Supper, and you can see through the windows, and you see the agony in the garden.
You see the agony in the garden, you see the arrest, and you see the crucifixion. So you see how these stories from the moment of the Last Supper, from Holy Thursday and the Last Supper, the story telescopes into the Passion of Christ. So everything is summed up in one single panel. The Vatican Agony in the Garden, very, very small representation, is really one of the very, very few images of this sort that you will see in Rome. In this city, there's something of a dearth of agony in the garden scenes. And actually, in the history of art, there are very few. There's a flurry right around the late 1400s and the early 1500s in which you get some of the finest painters, Andrea Mantegna, Giovanni Bellini. The great Venetian painters all take a stab at this image of the agony of the garden. They all represent it in the same way. And by the way, the same way that Cosimo Rosselli represents the image. Three apostles asleep in the lowest corner of the painting, the part that's closest to the viewer. Jesus raised up on a mount, generally with his back to us, so we don't really see what's going on. And in some images that derive from St. Luke, particularly Mantegna's as well as Rosselli's, in these images they have the angel that brings the chalice or some indication of the Jesus who sweat drops of blood and the angel who came to strengthen him in this struggle. But amazingly enough, the thing that I find particularly interesting about talking about the subject is that some works of art take a long time to create an iconography. So, for example, our vision of the Immaculate Conception of the Blessed Virgin, which everybody's mind, you know, Mary wearing the white with the light blue, and she's standing on a serpent, and she's standing, and you've got the crown of stars around her head. This imagery that immediately will come to everyone's mind. It took 800 years to create that image. And what I found when I was thinking about this and looking through all the images, that the person who really captured the spirit of the agony of the garden was actually, captured in cinema. It took cinema to create the idea of the agony of the garden. And when
You'll have to explain that one, because we didn't have cinema until what, 1920?
Until 2001 is where I'm going, or 2003. And the arrival of the movie The Passion, which many people have many different issues with, but there are many things that perhaps are not the consecration of iconography. However, the agony of the garden in the garden, I do not think has ever been better depicted. It's the opening of the movie. It's drawn, the whole story of the movie is drawn and supplemented not only from the gospel but from the visions of the blessed Anne Catherine Emmerich. But this the word agony comes from the Greek agone. It is only used once in the gospel, and the word means struggle. Piazza Navona here in Rome is actually from the term agone, which are the agonistic games, the competitions that took place in the Piazza Navona when it was the stadium of Domitian. They use this term once in the gospel. They use it for Jesus's struggle in the garden and this preparation. And the way that Mel Gibson captures this heroic Christ, you know, beaten to the ground with his fear, then getting up and getting ready to face the battle. Really, it opens up a whole new way of thinking about, a way of meditating on, a way of feeling close to one of the hardest aspects of Christ's passion. You know, we the physical torture we all know about, we have plenty of images of, but that emotional difficulty of knowing what's ahead. He's God. He knows what's coming. And then to have his friends all falling asleep, to have his friends left behind. So the sense of abandonment with which he goes into the ring. And I would like to just bring up that in the history of Christian art and literature, this idea that the agony of the garden presents to us, of the hero who awaits the moment of battle, the hero who's getting ready to step out into the ring, it has been picked up and created some of the greatest works of art that you and I know. For example, Michelangelo's famous David in the Academia, where it's not David in the middle of the ring, it's not David after the battle, it's David in that moment when he prepares to step out and face Goliath. It's a very interesting thing to remember in our world, that as much as Hollywood or the pop culture, or even, you know, pop music tries to deny it, a great many of our most powerful forms of imagery, they come from the Christian tradition.
Let's go back a moment to this image in the Sistine Chapel. Here we look at these three apostles who are lying with their backs to Jesus, who's there on the mount praying. And in a way, I think we Christians, we see ourselves mirrored in these three disciples who do have our backs turned to Jesus. We've left him in his moment of dire need.
All these images, more so than the Cosimo Rosselli, which of course is a papal commission, but the actual panel paintings of the Agony in the Garden are usually private commissions. They're commissioned by wealthy gentlemen, people who put them up as a kind of private devotional piece. And in that particular form of commission, that's exactly what this is about. The emphasis tends to be on the apostles, who, as a matter of fact, if you see in this image, a lot of them, or if somebody Googles them or pulls out an art book, you'll find them in these very good artists such as Mantegna and Bellini, who were experts at foreshortening, that is, making a part of the body seem close to you and part of the body seem far away from you. You'll find that the bodies of one of the apostles is usually foreshortened towards you. So it's really a link to you in looking towards the painting. So this is sort of a radical shift that takes place when these images were first commissioned, or this flurry of commissions in the late 1400s. They represent more of a meditation on our own inadequacy to be a friend to Jesus in need, our own incapacity to stay awake, to stay with him all the way through to the end. And at the same time, it does re-emphasize Christ's loneliness, because from that you can extrapolate, you can project into, you know, Jesus alone on the mountain suffering. But I think the Renaissance is very much a very humanist-centric age, something that they're concerned a lot about the patron. The patron sees himself, the patron wants to put himself. So I think actually what makes the modern shift interesting is to put the focus back on Jesus again.
And thanks there to Elizabeth Lev, professor of Christian art and architecture at Duquesne University's Rome campus.